In the quiet spaces between the questions, we gather the shimmering threads of memory and emotion. Each story is a strand, fragile, true, aching with life. We weave them gently into the tapestry of what it means to be. We're curious, but we're not collectors of curiosities. We are keepers of resonance. We listen not just to words, but to what pulses beneath them. We do not seek answers. We seek echoes. The tremble of one heart remembering another, remembering itself. We are the Thread Weavers, and this is Emotion Art. Once you get into podcasting, you start to realize that there is a ton of hoopla around monetizing and what that means and what algorithms to plug into and how to get sponsors. And like, I'm supposed to read a blurb to you about some random product I don't even use so I can make a few cents. But I want to tell you about something real instead. Something I care about. You all already know Angela, artistic partner, editor extraordinaire. Well, the fundamental sense is Angela's massage practice. She offers 2 and 3 hour massages in a couple different formats because she feels like real healing takes time. Angela's not going to fix something quick, but she is going to find the source of the problem instead of treating the symptoms. If you're tired of generic massages that feel like trying to find the snooze button for your pain, or you're tired of not getting massages, worse yet, check out The Fundamental Sense at thefundamentalsense.com and book a session with her today. I can tell you from more than a decade of personal experience, you will be very glad you did. Oh, and ask her where she got the name The Fundamental Sense from. It's super interesting. My first memories of Teresa are from the most chaotic part of my life. Right after leaving the Jim Roberts group, living in downtown Portland, going to school, being in society for the first time, and Teresa basically stepped into that prolonged train wreck. What a foundational component of my life she's been. I've always appreciated Teresa. She's quirky as hell, super fun, so smart, very organized brain. I think she sees herself as disorganized, but I don't know that actually. Scatterbrained. That's probably just because Dad would always sing the "She's as lovely as a rainbow, as delightful as the rain. Isn't it a pity that she's such a scatterbrain?" Something like that. Okay, mostly Grandpa would sing that. But Dad did too. All right, anyway. Her fashion is impeccable. Like, she wears, she has so much texture and color, and she does it so well. She's a woman that is fully herself. She is grounded. She's also a big part of who I am, why I am the way I am. I can't even begin to imagine what my life would be like if that rock of stability had not stepped into the chaos in Portland. Also, I'd like to point out that Teresa is a gypsy. And we recorded this conversation in her gypsy caravan that she and Dad built on a flatbed trailer. That's one of the coolest tow-behind caravans I've ever seen. So intricate. So colorful. It has a little tiny baby potbelly stove in it that works. If you hear bells chiming during the conversation, it's just because we were in a gypsy wagon. We'll put some pictures on the website. So this is a conversation that I had with Teresa, my stepmom. I wasn't expecting this conversation to start with. It was kind of spur of the moment for me. I think it's something that Teresa's been thinking about for a while. At least I hope so, because she was so organized. And I was not expecting the content at all. And the entire conversation was a surprise to me. Being surprised is one of my favorite things, so thank you. I'm very much looking forward to sitting down with Teresa and getting her story at some point in the future. Until then, here is Teresa's unique perspective on some of my story. Enjoy.
Welcome to Emotion Art.
Emotion Art, where we sit down and make art
with our emotions.
Emotion Art.
Creative energy moving outward in conscious expression of feeling.
Emotion Art.
Emotion, because we are literally made of emotion. Art, because everything we do wants to be art. Emotion Art.
Feels. Emotion Art.
It's all beautiful. Emotion Art.
A space for emotional art. Creative energy moving outward in conscious expression.
Emotion Art.
An emotion art gallery.
This is Emotion Art.
You're welcome.
I'm now very pleased to report that we are recording.
Okay.
I got to get my radio personality on. Fortunately, it doesn't require a personality to do this kind of thing. Therefore, someone like me can.
This is really important. That way I can be ready for Joe Rogan.
Actually, that's a really great agenda.
God, I pray that you be here and help me to communicate what's in my heart clearly, and help me not to forget important details. Just help me to be here, be present, be a blessing in Jesus' name.
Amen. Hi, Teresa.
Hey, Michael.
I'm really glad to be sitting here with you.
I've been looking forward to this.
You and me both.
This is my understanding. I get to say anything I want. No limits.
This is your conversation.
I really like that, because there's been way too many limits on people's speech.
Do you plan to put this to the test? If you actually do have the ability to say anything you want here.
This is not going to be put to the test.
Yes. I hope that you say exactly what you want to.
My main objective is to, I want to clarify some things, and I want to make it clear how much I love you as a son and as a stepmother and stepping into that role. And so I want to start, I've got some notes. So we're going back in time, and I'm going to talk about when I first met you. You were 2 years old, and I showed you yesterday, I pointed out Calvin to you, and I said, that's what you look like, except picture him with dark hair. You just had these big inquisitive eyes, and you were just interested in everything around you. So my first major encounter was so cute. Sater had to go to the fabric store. So I went along, and Stan was driving in the front, and you were sitting in the front. Apparently, there were no car seat laws at that time. So you're just sitting there, and it was this big car with the, you know, the big long seat, and your feet were sticking out, and they didn't go down at all. They just went straight out, and the feet ended where the seat ended. It was so cute. And then we got to the store, and we had to wait because the store wasn't open yet. So we were waiting a few minutes. Stan started to sing to you, and he was singing that song, "It's Getting Darker Now, and It Is Time for Us to Sleep." And he sang through the whole song, and you were just sitting there looking up at him with those big eyes. It was so precious, so cute. It was one of those things just you never forget because of how cute it was.
I remember that song.
Yeah.
I sometimes sing that song still.
We've sung it to the grandkids. I think it's a Shiloh song. And as I traveled around, you know, I wouldn't see you all the time. I'd just see you periodically. We're in this city, and you and your mom or your dad happened to be in the same city, and then I would see you.
This is in the Brothers and Sisters.
In the Traveling Fellowship.
Okay.
Yeah. And you would get up early, earlier than everybody else. And so when I was doing the meal, I'd come into the kitchen, and you'd be sitting at the table, like, ready for the day, like, you know, I'm ready. How come nobody else is? And you always had questions, always questions. And the next big memory, I call them precious memories, because these were the little seeds that caused me to love you and your siblings, mind you. And each sibling, it's a little different stories, but this is your story. So the next memory, we were in Albuquerque, and we had three tiny little houses, and there was kind of a gravel road in front, and we stayed in all three of them. So one day, I was sitting in the middle. There was a little bench outside the house, right where the road goes by. And Stan comes by, and he's, you know, tall, and he's got this long garment.
Brother shirt.
Yes. And he's just walking, you know, really uprightly, just walking along, playing the flutophone to the other house. And you weren't right behind him. It was like a minute or two past, and here come you along, long shirt, playing the flutophone. It was so adorable. And
in Albuquerque.
Those are my memories of you in the traveling group.
Like snapshots.
Snapshots.
Yeah, okay.
So then I left, and you guys left the traveling group. And
you left first?
I left first.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
I'm going to go into the details of some of the history of what exactly happened that I don't think you're going to hear from anybody else.
Oh, my goodness. This is so exciting.
And so I left, and then I was traveling around still trying to figure out, what am I going to do with my life? And I had bought this old vehicle called the Green Tomato. We called it the Green Tomato because it was the color of a green tomato. And Louise and I were in...
Did I ever see that car?
No, because it got stolen.
Okay.
We were in Vancouver, BC. Her mother was dying, so we decided to travel across Canada. But her mother died before we got there. So we picked apples in Quebec. And then there was a brother that had been with the group in New York City. And he needed somebody to watch his apartment. So he asked us. Now, Stan had already called me, because I was out of the group 2 years. Stan just left. And he was in trouble because he was like, I need to hire somebody to watch the kids. I need to work. Well, I was already committed to this trip.
So how old were you? About?
29.
Okay. Larking around basically the world with your friend to some degree.
Yeah, doing all kinds of things. So we get to New York to watch this guy's apartment. Now, the Green Tomato, you have to understand about the Green Tomato. The Green Tomato was a wonderful car, but it was a bad car. The Green Tomato was real particular, and if it was cold, it would not start. The only way you could start it is if you got canning jars, mason canning jars full of hot water, and put them all over the engine before you're going to start it, and then you'd open the engine, take them all out, put them in the back seat, and it would start. It was a bad car.
Was it a Volkswagen?
It was a Mazda. Okay. It was a rotary engine Mazda, which they don't even make them anymore, because it's probably why they don't make them anymore. It was a beater car.
I don't know anything about engines. I'll take your word on it.
It was such a bad car when we were in Quebec. It would defrost this little oval area in the front with a defrost all the way on. You kind of have to lean and look out the window to see where you're going. So this is a bad car. So we're in New York, and Brandon, our friend, was off meeting his fiance's family, and we're just tooling around New York, seeing the old sights. And then one morning, I woke up and I looked out the window, and the Green Tomato was gone. And I'm looking out the window, and then I started laughing, and I said, who would want to steal the Green Tomato?
Yeah.
So we called the police, and we're telling them like this and that and all the details, license, and there was a couple police officers in the front, and I'm sitting in the back giving them all the information. And then I said, what is the chance that we'll, you know, be able to retrieve this car? And the two police officers looked at each other, and they started laughing. In a Brooklyn accent, they said, lady, 100 cars get stolen a day. You're not seeing that car again. So I was still amused, because it was a beater car.
Like the ransom of the Red Chief.
Yes, Exactly.
You don't know what you just kidnapped. I am so sorry, but good luck.
It's never gonna start. And they don't know the mason jar trick.
Yeah, well.
So, because this is winter, this is like December.
Yeah.
Now, bear in mind, I had just prayed before this all happened in New York, first time in my life. I'm like 29. Never prayed that God would bring me a husband. Never. Mm. Because I'm just like, I'm just going to do God's work. You know, if I get married, I get married. But at this point, I'm like, I need a husband. I want to have a family. I want children.
Do you mind if I ask a couple of questions?
No, anytime.
I'm curious about, so why did you leave the group? And then what was your direction? Like, were you church hopping? Were you like, how did you reintegrate into society after that? Or what did you do?
Not well.
So why did you leave in the first place?
I'm going to give you a short answer.
Sure.
Because that's a completely another story.
Okay. And no answer is just as satisfying.
But this is the short answer.
Okay.
You know how the group had all these rules and just the way you dress, there's a Bible verse that says, first cleanse the inside of the cup and platter that the outside would also be clean.
Mm-hmm.
I did the opposite. I did all this outward stuff. And then as the years went by, I realized, because we lived a life where you didn't really get confronted with falling into sin because we were so protected. It was like a little cushion all around us with all the rules and things. So I started seeing all this stuff inside of me, which is a completely another story.
Oh, yes.
Also, I clearly saw corruption in the leadership. So I needed to leave. So as far as my goals, it was all about what next, Lord? That's all. Just what next? And I literally prayed that the next man that would ask me to marry him, which indicates there was a few others, the next man that asked me to marry him would be the one that God wanted me to marry.
Mm.
So at the time, there was these companies that did what's called driveway cars. People wanted a car delivered. They just wanted it delivered cheap. And so you just call the different companies and find out you want to go to the city. Do you have a car going? You only had to pay a down payment, which you got back, a small insurance fee, and gas. That's it. Mm. It was a great deal. A lot of people traveled around at that time like that. So we were calling for cars going to San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. Seattle's close to where I'm from. Portland, I knew I had a job taking care of you kids.
Mm.
And San Francisco, we knew people. I just wanted to get out of New York City. So we got a car to Portland. And I looked at the scene when I got to Portland. Don was living in the house. There's another guy. I can't even remember his name. The girls at the time were downstairs. So I got a room downstairs. And I told Stan, I could see he was going to crash and burn. He was working a lot. The kids were just basically on the streets of Portland, you know, just hanging out with some nice kids, but some, you know, there's a lot of drug stuff going on, a lot of stuff. I knew that he was in trouble. So I told him, I said, Stan, I'll stay here for 2 months to help you get together domestically. And he's like, great. So Louise went back up to Canada and I stayed there just taking care of you guys.
Mm.
And it was about a little over a month into my time there. I was talking to Stan. Stan always come down. I'd make breakfast for everybody. He'd have breakfast, and then you guys would come down, and Don took you to school.
Don Shepherd.
Don Shepherd.
Yes.
He lived there.
I remember in his rabbit, his little diesel rabbit, and he worked out in the Dalles.
He did all kinds of things.
He's a knife sharpener.
Yeah, he did that. And he was on call at the hospital to translate if they had a Spanish-speaking patient. He did all kinds of stuff. He was working at the school. He was teaching Spanish at the school.
He was always in a good frame of humor.
Yeah.
And he would just make jokes about everything that we saw on the road. And oh my goodness. And when I married Bonnie, he gave us some Japanese haircutting scissors.
Oh.
It's the only wedding gift that I remember.
And probably still have.
we use it all. Angela's the hair cutter. Everyone goes to her. And those scissors work as good as the first. I think he sharpened them once. Okay. Side trail. You brought that memory up. Those your fault.
Know, that's one of the things I'm hoping to do. So one morning I got there early and Stan was setting the fire and he's turning and looking at me, talking. And all of a sudden it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I am falling in love with this man. oh no, I need to leave. And I literally thought Stan would never marry.
Yeah.
I actually thought he would stay single until it was okay for him to be with Lisa. That's what I thought.
Why did you think that?
I don't know.
Okay, just your impression. Just your gut.
My impression.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Yep.
And so I'm like, okay, I got to leave. This is going to be a disappointment. I ought to stay, but this isn't. This is dangerous. 3 days later, I'm still pondering what to do. Come down. You guys were still asleep, and we're at opposite ends of the table. And Stan looks at me, and he goes, "I was wondering if you'd do me a favor." And I'm thinking, oh, he's figured out. Okay, she's in trouble. She's falling. I need to ask her to leave. That's what I thought. So he goes, oh, would you marry me? And I'm like, what? Because there was no dinner date, nothing. Just, would you marry me? I thought he was proposing a marriage of convenience. Like, you're broke. You have no future. And I'm in trouble. You know, maybe this would be convenient. Mm-hmm. I thought that's what he was proposing. Mm-hmm. So I said, I wouldn't marry somebody that doesn't love me. And he said, that's the problem. And so I said, well, I'm not saying no. But I had to think about what you guys would want. I had to think about all four of you, how it would affect you. And I'm going to tell you this. You guys were a big plus as to why I wanted to marry Stan. Big plus. Number one, I saw you guys desperately needed me. And I loved you guys, all of you. Still do, every one of you. I love Jessica and her wispy hair that she always had. She was so active, and she's like a little deer. And then Mariah with all her cute little curls and her cute ways and your inquisitive eyes and your questions, and Isaac and his his funny habits. He would walk like this, make this big circle. If a bunch of sisters were sitting in a circle, he'd make this big circle so he didn't have to get stopped and answer any questions. I just loved you guys.
Of course he did.
Yes.
Oh, that's so funny.
Just love you guys. So everything worked out.
It's like you are already invested in our story.
Big time.
Because how long were you in the Jim Arps group for? I'm not going back to that story.
10 years.
And then you left 2 years before Dad did. So that means that you had... Math is really, really hard for me.
About 4 years, about close to 4 years.
So you spent 4 years traveling with us. Okay. I mean, that was too early for me to remember. But because we were kids, you were probably often with us.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah, okay.
Quite a bit.
Because we would have been with primary sister camps.
Yeah, quite a bit. And, you know, I'd even hear about you when, you know, I didn't see you.
Yeah. But there weren't a lot of other kids. Like, there were a few families around that time that had kids. The Malaspins, right? They were part. Because I remember playing with Kipsaya. I don't know that I remember any others.
Another thing I should point out at this point is both your parents, particularly Stan, because this is one of the reasons I left. One of the thinking I had is, why am I here? I would never raise children here. Because I didn't approve of the way a lot of the parents raised their kids. Stan protected you guys majorly. And so did Lisa. I saw not so much because she was, I'm going to say weaker, more reticent. Stan was very strong, and he always had like special things for you guys to do. Like you guys were always doing some project. I remember it was in Glenwood where he made like a Lorena stove, a little Lorena stove. And
I remember this.
Made a clay pot, and you guys cooked salsa in the clay pot and had salsa, and it was all homemade, and the Lorena stove was homemade. And he did stuff like that with you guys. Other dads didn't do that. They're just like, we're just serving the Lord, and they would just go on and just expect their kids just to be quiet.
Teresa, I have so many little snapshots right now of making bricks, of making bread, of cooking grasshoppers, of harvesting like the cattails, of leaching acorns and making acorn bread. And I remember Dad, like, it's like I can hear his voice saying one of the outcomes he appreciated from his projects was that it benefited all the people around him who had no ambition to be part of it, but they still benefited. They still came and tried the bread and enjoyed the experience. And that is so weird. It's like I can remember a conversation, but I can't remember specific words. Anyway,
This is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you.
Yeah.
One of the reasons.
This is great.
Now, where am I? I'm back, and Stan and I married, and this is one of the hard parts. Stan and I married, and I started to realize that what had happened was Stan had left the group, took you guys, and wrote a letter to Lisa and left it with her gear. Apparently, she was never read the letter, as I understand. I think she gave it to the brothers. Mm. He let her know he was going to be in Portland and was hoping and praying she would join you. And so when you got to Portland, and when he talked to you in, it was Albuquerque, he gave you guys the choice. And he said he thought Lisa would join him in Portland. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason you guys made the choice to go is you assumed your mother was going to join. I don't believe you, neither did he. None of you thought this is a division between mom and dad and this is going to break up the family. So you guys went to Portland. You all set the table for her every night. And I found out that you would cry yourself to sleep every night. Mm. Isaac, he was so young. I think a lot of this went over his head. And, you know, Mariah's just, she's kind of like, where's the fun? You know, but you were the one that was really, really hurt. And here
I am. At least that showed it. That was more, I was more expressive. Right. I didn't bury it.
Yes. The others.
Or
probably kept it under.
And Isaac was probably too young to even be able to, like, to him it's just like, okay, everything's been changing my whole life and here we are. And
another change. Yeah, you know, yeah, he was used to leaving, getting separated from his dad.
And Mariah has always been like, well, just ran through that wall. All right. Well, what, pick ourselves up and let's keep going.
She still is.
Yes, she is. Okay.
She still is. Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
I married Stan and then I had this interesting balancing act because I needed to love you guys, but I needed to not take Lisa's place. Mm. I needed to make sure that you loved her and respected her, although I disagreed with her decision. And it was a balancing act.
Wow.
And it was hard for me because I just wanted to love you and love you like a mom. I mean, okay, yeah, I know how to raise children. So it was a challenge. And it was very precious to me. And we had some great times. I remember up in Chip and Clara's, up in the wooded area where we didn't have electricity. And Desiree was a baby. Do you remember that at all? You guys stayed upstairs.
I remember a jar of honey with garlic bulbs hanging by the door. Is that the right place?
It was probably to keep away vampires.
No. And that's where the reservoir was?
Yeah.
Out there?
Yeah, you guys would go back and go fishing and you'd go wandering. Mm-hmm. You guys had so much fun.
I'm trying to imagine that now, like an 8 and 9 year old. Just going back to a reservoir in the middle of the forest. No one ever goes there. Like people go to fish every once in a while. And neither of us knew how to swim. It's like a trek through the woods. Like we don't do that. We don't give our kids those freedoms anymore.
Right. You guys had a blast.
I feel a sense of appreciation because I remember being out there and I taught myself how to swim by going out as deep as I could possibly do it. And then on my tiptoes and then jumping backwards deeper. That's how I learned how to swim, just me and Isaac.
Oh, that's so like, funny.
Yeah, and I was fine. And I appreciate that. Okay,
it was very precious. Very precious times. Mm-hmm. It was a blast. Desiree was a baby. She'd make you guys laugh. And it was really nice. I'm going to just go forward a little bit more, and then I'm going to go back.
Right.
So, you know, Mariah had left. And then she was gone for, 2 years?
She went back, I think, just about like very soon after.
Very soon, which I'm going to go back to.
Yeah. And then she was there until I was 11. Yes. And that's when we switched places.
And then you switched places. Now, talk about what you went through when you lost your mom. Mm. Isaac went through that when he lost his brother. Because he looked to you. You were the fun one. You were the one that came up with all the fun stuff. Mm. Like whenever you were with kids, you were the leader. You were like, let's do this. And and Isaac just followed you. Just followed you. And all of a sudden you were gone. And I don't even know how he handled that. I really don't. He really didn't have friends. And the first real friend. You might have heard him talk about Matthew Mock, who is still a friend of the kids. He's a good friend of Jimmy. That was his friend, and he used to do really amazing. They would just do a lot of fun stuff. But that was the first person that really took that place of missing you. Just like what happened to you, that was right there is where the sorrow of the whole thing hit, Isaac.
I have never thought of that before. Never in my life has it occurred to me that to a 9-year-old, that would have felt like being left.
Yeah.
Well, to anyone.
Yeah.
With no explanation. And no, because I had no explanation either. I was just in the speck in the tsunami myself. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back now. And I want to paint a picture for you of what happened.
Okay. Oh, you use sticky notes. I love this.
So when Stan joined, he had no intention of joining. He had met the group years before and was intrigued. But at this point, he had a family, responsibilities. He was involved in India. And Lisa met some of the sisters. Stan had gone to India, and she spent time with the sisters. And then out of the blue, Lisa says to Stan, I love that sister, speaking of Anava.
Of Anava.
Yes. And okay. She said, regardless of what you do, I'm going to join this group. And Stan's like, what do I do here? I mean, he didn't have a lot of choices. He could say, that's fine, you can join, but you're not taking the kids. Could have said that. Could have said, no, you're not. Well, that's not going to work. You know, he doesn't have any control over her.
Mm-hmm.
Or he could have joined, and that's what he did. Now, what I want to paint to you is who Stan is and Jim Roberts, the two of those two. And I have questions for you. So Stan joined, and from the get-go, Jim Roberts would tell the brothers when Stan wasn't there, he would say, he's not a brother. And he would also warn them, be careful, he's very persuasive. Why did Jim Roberts single Stan out to say he's not a brother when he never did that with anyone else? What was the reason in your mind?
He felt threatened by him.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe that.
I 100% believe it. That's something that I know. Like, that's an interesting perspective in how he did that. The thing is that I have seen Jim Roberts treat other people that way, but they were always people who threatened his authority, people that had an idea and could vocalize it intelligently.
Yes. But that's he dumped people.
The purpose of speaking about them in that way is it's basically you're writing them up three times so that then you can fire them.
Right. Yes. Exactly. So why didn't he dump Stan? Because he did that plenty of times. He would just send them on the
years.
Road. He'd send people on the road and then not communicate with them, and they'd just be lost.
Yeah.
Or he'd just plain tell them to leave. Why did he not do that to Stan?
The answer that comes to mind is, like Dad said, he felt like that was about to happen to him, and I believe that he was about to do it to him. But
right.
But that doesn't answer your question. I don't
Stan
know.
Stan had heard that from people.
I don't know
It's
that.
Not like he was a brother, and then all of a sudden, oh, he did this,
yes.
So I'm going to get... He was never a brother.
Yes, yes, okay.
And so why did he let that drag on? What was his purpose? Why did he not send Stan away?
I mean, the only thing that would occur to me is because he felt compassion for the kids, but I don't think that he thought that way. So I don't know. Why? Why do you think?
If he had compassion for the kids...
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense with everything I know about him.
He would have kept Stan with the kids.
Yeah. Why do you think he didn't send him away?
I think he was afraid of Stan. I think he was afraid of what Stan would do.
If he still had the kids?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I think he profoundly misunderstood who Stan was.
Mm-hmm.
He saw him as an enemy. And the whole time he was there, he was the adversary. There was nobody else he treated that way.
Yeah.
So then, here's the next question. Why do you think he kept sending Stan away from you guys? Stan was like, I want to be with my kids. What is this? And the brother evangelist would say, I was under the impression you wanted to go out and do evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
As if him being with you
gaslighting.
Would have excluded him from being able to do evangelism. Why was he sent away? Stan said it was years during the whole time that he was separated from the kids.
And that feels true with with my feelings of how all of that was, those dynamics. Although I don't know myself specifically, but the same reason that everyone uses gaslighting to make you feel like an impossible situation and give up because you want something, which in Jim Roberts' group, in the path you're taking, he wanted dad to make himself go away. He wanted dad to give up so that he wouldn't have to deal with him moving heaven and earth to find us, because that's what would have happened. That makes sense.
So this is going on, and I believe he was afraid of Stan.
Yes.
And I believe that's one of the reasons he kept sending him away. I think his preference would be for Stan to give up.
Yes.
Just give up and go home.
That makes sense.
That way there's no repercussions. So finally, Stan was told by two brothers, the elder's going to get rid of you and keep the kids. So Stan knew, okay, I got to get the kids out. So he had that pretty fortuitous situation where he's traveling and the brother that was, I think it was Thomas.
Thomas told him?
Thomas took him to Albuquerque.
Who were the two brothers that told him?
Larry and Shalom.
Larry Jones.
Yeah.
Shalom. I remember him. Long gray, like, beard. Well, everyone had a long beard.
That was Samuel. Oh. Samuel had Shalom. A long
okay,
beard.
Okay, yes, Samuel.
With a white streak.
So who was... Okay, anyway. That brings back a strong memory, but I
think Samuel told him that, too, but it was after Stan was already gone. Oh, yeah, that was
all. These are all
the
people
plan.
I have not thought of in a long time. Okay.
So Stan knew Thomas was going to stop so that Stan could see the kids he wasn't supposed to in Albuquerque, so Stan could see his kids. And Stan knew he was in trouble. He knew he needed to do something. He knew that there was the potential of just getting dropped off somewhere and you wouldn't know where you guys were. So when he was in Albuquerque, he did that whole thing where we're going to go for a walk and talk to you guys.
That was in Albuquerque?
I believe it. Was it Phoenix?
I think it was in Denver.
Oh, possibly. I don't remember.
That's what I remember. Is it being Denver?
It's probably Denver. I'm sure I have that
okay.
one. He took you all and you guys all said, yeah, let's go. And, you know, you all thought Lisa was going to come. He left the letter, went to Portland. Jim Roberts was afraid of Stan and thought that Stan was going to be retaliatory. Stan is not retaliatory in any wise. That's not him. Jim Roberts never knew who Stan is. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, as soon as Stan heard, this was just a few months after you guys all left, as soon as he knew that Lisa was going to be in Chicago visiting her family, he sent all of you to go see her, which was an indication. He wasn't being retaliatory. He didn't want to keep you away from your mother. He wanted you to have access to your mother. So he sent you all on a plane to Chicago. I remember taking you to the airport, and I messed up because I was so naive about flights and everything. Oh, the flight is at 4. We'll get there at 4. We got there like 10 minutes before. It's like running through the airport trying to get you on your flight. Mm. I feel like an idiot.
Mm. But you made it happen.
Yeah. You guys got there.
And that shows trust, too, that he would send us after he had to go through what he had to go through to get us.
Yes.
So not only was he not retaliating, but he was choosing to trust in the face of what to him should have felt like a situation he could not trust.
Right. So you all went there, and, you know, I don't know the details at all of that visit, the trip, but Mariah then decided to stay with her mother. And then the rest of you flew back, and that was a challenge for Stan to give up his daughter. That was hard on Jessica now, because the two of them were really close. This went on then for, she was 11, 12, 13, 2 years at least, 2.5 years that she was gone. And then there was the switch back. And then you went there. Now, this is the point, the whole reason I want to explain this all to you. I'm getting to the point that I want to get across to you. Mariah came home, and then there was this little time of switcheroo where Lisa was still in Portland, and we had already moved down to Bandon. But we went up to Portland, and there was this, I think we were up there.
Yeah, we switched in Portland. I remember it was right around my 11th birthday.
Yes.
And I remember spending a night with Mariah, like we all hung out for an evening.
Yes.
I remember we were playing with boxes in a basement or something. Like.
Yeah. So there was this little switcheroo where Mariah's like, I'm done. And you were like, I'm going to go be with mom. And then Stan made that negotiation. Well, he has to call once a month because, you know, he had lost that contact with Mariah. We're not doing that again. The fact that Stan was able to negotiate that was bizarre in itself because they never did stuff like that. They never made deals like that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, I still believe that Jim Roberts saw him as public enemy number one.
I've always understood that to be true.
Right. He would warn people when they left. He'd say, okay, you're leaving. Just don't have anything to do with Stan Avery. That's how afraid he was.
He even did that to me. When I left, when I was 15, that's what he said. Well, if you want to leave, your sister is in Tennessee with an Amish community, and you can go there. If you want to go to live with your dad, then you're not going to be welcome back.
Right. So that was the spiel.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I never understood until I listened to your podcast with Angela, and I realized something I had never realized before. And this is what I want to get across to you, because it hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm going to go back in time again and explain to you who Leonard is.
Okay. I remember Leonard.
Leonard was an evil man. He was a cruel man. And I was a really compliant sister. I never caused trouble. I never, you know, I just tried to be loving, do evangelism, just, you know, go along with the whole thing.
But you've always been an activist at heart, full of energy and
apparently, because there was a few bigger. Times, there was a few times I took a stand.
Yeah.
So I was in a city with Leonard, and I saw him treat a man so cruelly. It was so cruel. The man was crying. And Leonard cast him out of the group, told him he had to give him the shirt they had given him, had to give it back. This man was just crying. And we're all like, and I'm like, And even like we all fled out of that. We were camped out. We all fled because this guy was being sent away. Who knows why he was? He's just kind of a gentleman, kind of a little bit of a doofus guy, not very smart, but really tenderhearted. And Leonard was cruel. Mm. And so when we left, we went on the road. And as we were leaving, Steve Demetrio looked at us and he said something to indicate that he knew this was wrong. Mm. Just to confirm, he could see it in our faces. This is just wrong. Mm. And so I'm like, I've got to talk to the elder about this. This is just over the edge, the way Leonard had treated him. As soon as I saw Jim Roberts, I told him about the event, how this young man had been treated, and how cruel Leonard had been. And Jim Roberts surprised me because he said, you're not the only one that brought this report. Now, I knew of other occasions of Leonard dealing unkindly, cruelly, but this one was over the edge. And when you were telling your story, because Brother Evangelist knew that Leonard was a cruel man, and he decided to put him in charge over you.
Here's what comes to my mind. For some reason, he put Leonard in charge over sisters' camps often. The thing that comes to my emotions immediately when you ask that question is because he didn't know quite where to put me. I was in between because I was 13, 14. At first, I was in sister camps a lot. That's when I was with Leonard. Then after that, I got shifted to brothers' camps a lot. That's when I was with Hatzir and Jonathan and Ted. So that's what comes to me. But
okay. There was lots of brothers he could have put in oversight over you. Like there was one sister, Magdalene was the woman's name. He put Paul in charge over her kids. He knew who Leonard was. when I heard you, I started crying. Mm. And I realized I could be wrong in my assessment, but that was retaliation.
Because that's how I came back to the group, was with Leonard, and it was months. That was the longest place I was.
Yeah.
That is so interesting.
I believe that was a retaliation because Stan was public enemy number one. Because in his mind, Stan won when he took the kids.
Mm-hmm.
How much better could he get back at Stan than to afflict you with the worst, meanest, cruelest brother he could? I believe he used you as a pawn. And he was still using you as a pawn when he said, yeah, you can go to the army. He was still using you as a pawn to get back at Stan. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. And the reason I want to get that across to you is so that you would understand that the input that Leonard was having in your life, the purpose of it was not to bring you into understanding about God. It was, I am going to tweak Stan Avery. And that's still happening. Jim Roberts has died and all those people that, there's kind of at loose ends. They're still, don't go to Stan Avery's.
Wait, who just told me that a couple of...
Two brothers did.
Who was that? Who so just came through here?
Yes. And I think this was the death knell of the group, actually.
Really?
Because they were very committed still to the group, wanting the group to succeed. They came here without permission. We're going to talk to Stan Avery. And they stayed for a number of days, the friends of Steve Donnelly. Gabrielle and Micaiah were their names. I don't know if you know them.
I don't. And I don't think I do.
You might, because people change their names. Kind of like your son, Lucas. They change their names over time.
Charlie, Bob.
Yeah, I changed my name plenty of times.
You used to be Noah.
Yes. Yes.
That's how it was really hard for me to think to change that, my thoughts of you from Noah to Teresa.
Yes. So that's what I want to get across to you is do not let a person that's, I don't want to judge the man. I mean, he was in Vietnam. He's got his own issues. You know, I don't know.
Leonard, yeah.
Leonard.
Oh, he was in Vietnam?
Yeah. Ooh. Leonard and Jim Roberts. Do not let them have any victory, Michael, over you and how you think and how you perceive, because they had an agenda and you were the pawn and you were just a child. You know, who knows? Who knows?
As I've become more and more aware of how skewed my perspective of Christianity and what morality and immorality and heaven and hell and God's plan for us and judgment and all of that stuff, how it all works, to me, it was this morass of evil. Just a hideous horror, and makes a lot of sense. Everyone else is like, well, that's actually not Christianity. I'm like, well, how did I was raised around, all, like, raised by all these same people, but that would have changed the whole story. That, in that impressionable moment with a chameleon child, is all I wanted to do was please and serve, obey, and like all the fruits of the Spirit and everything I've been, I just wanted to. That's what I wanted to do. And so that would have been the perfect formula to majorly traumatize that little brain.
So the next thing I want to say to you is, you know, I'm a spiritual person.
I get that sense.
The first time I heard the Lord's voice was when I was 5.
Really?
Did I ever tell you that story?
Probably, maybe, but that's very interesting.
So Elizabeth and I were playing and we were at my grandma's house. And grandma decided to give us each a piece of her junk jewelry. Now it's probably worth a lot of money because it was, you know, like, this was many years ago, like 60 years ago. Yeah, over 60 years ago. So she gave us each one, and mine was all shiny. It was like a butterfly or something, all these tiny little blue and white stones that glistened and were glittery. Both of them were pins. Hers was one dark green stone. I think now I probably would like that one better. Mm. But both of us like the shiny light blue one, and we both got them. And Elizabeth goes, can I see yours? And I'm like, yeah. So I gave it to her to look at, and it clears anything. I heard the Lord say to me, you'll be happier if you trade with her. You'll be happier if you trade with her. And so I said to her, want to trade? And she goes, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, this feels good. I sure enough, his voice was right. In all my life, I haven't heard it like hugely. Every time I've heard his voice, he's always right. And I recognize his voice. And that's, I've told people that many years, that the first time I heard his voice was when I was 5.
When you say hear his voice, are you talking about
in my
head? It feels like you audibly, like you actually hear a voice with your ears. Does it feel like that?
It's in my head.
Okay.
And it is something I wouldn't think of almost every time.
Is that what lets you know? How do you know when you are hearing his voice? Whatever it is, the feeling that you are using that term to describe, what is the defining characteristic?
Well, I recognize it now because I know him. It's like if you called me on the phone, I'd recognize your voice because I know you. I recognize it now because I know him. But the hallmark is always there. Number one, it's something like if I'm asking a question and he gives me an answer, it's almost always something I wouldn't have thought of. And it's always right. And it's always kind.
Mm. Okay, so it's a whole myriad of things
yeah.
that taken together, you know it. You know it. Yeah, okay.
So I recognized as I went into Christianity more, hung out, that's unusual.
Very.
To me, that just seemed normal. And other people would be like, literally sometimes I'd get people kind of like, maybe I'm just going to move away from this woman slowly.
Because it's not as unusual to hear voices that don't have much kind to say, that are not kind voices, let's just say.
Well, demons, when demons speak, they're always, there's two things they're always saying, kill somebody else or kill yourself. It's almost always the case.
Yeah.
Or they're saying, you're destined to be the dictator of the country, so start behaving like a... It's almost always that, like that when people have demons. Demons, the scripture says that Satan comes to kill, steal, and destroy. Mm-hmm. And he's the father of lies, so he's lying. He's ready to kill that person or somebody else. It's always, almost always the case that that's what demons are whispering to people. Mm. With God, it's completely the opposite.
But it's like competing voices.
Not for me.
That's so confusing. Have you ever heard the whispers of demons? Like a different voice that you
yes.
were like, okay.
Yes. When one of my daughters was having trouble with, you know, when somebody's got an eating issue.
An eating disorder.
Yeah. There's a word for it, and I can't think of it right now. Not bulimia.
Oh, anorexia.
Anorexia.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were talking about it a lot and praying and talking to the girls about stuff. And I went into the bathroom and, you know, you kind of go through menopause, you start to kind of gain weight. So I'm like, I need to lose some weight. And I literally heard this voice in my head say, I can help. And I'm like, I don't think so. You need to leave.
Because you didn't recognize it.
Well.
Why? Why was that your reaction?
Because we were just talking to the girls about anorexia. And anorexia is almost always a demon. It's the demon that's doing the... It's always like, kill yourself or kill somebody else. So shouldn't eat, can't eat. Oh, no, you're too fat.
So you're saying that voice was the demon, like anorexia or whatever. Like
yeah.
it was like the demon that plants that idea. Interesting.
I think that's the only time I can think of where.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to go into a spiritual realm here with you.
Beautiful.
And the thing I'm going to talk to you about is the visions that I've had pertaining to you.
Okay.
And these are visions in my head. And you can think they're imaginations. And somebody might say, oh, those are just imaginations in your head. I'm not sure they're from God the way I know when I hear his voice that it's from God. But I'm almost, like I'm sure like 98% that it's a vision from God.
Mm.
When I hear his voice, 100%.
Mm.
So this was the first vision. Stan and I had come up to Corvallis and we're visiting and we went to church with you and Bonnie.
The Foursquare Church?
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
Yep. We were worshiping. Stan and I were sitting behind you because of all the boys in the church, and you and Bonnie were sitting in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
We're just worshiping the Lord, and I saw this vision. And in the vision, I saw these butterfly twirly little they looked like they were Disney drawn characters, and they were fluttering around. I mean, it was like Disney majorly, like you can even see like little lines behind the fluttering, and they were fluttering around Bonnie, and they were brushing against her cheek and just fluttering around, just looking really joyful. And then this whole swarm of, I wouldn't call it a swarm, it's just a few of little fluttery butterfly type creatures went up, and they went over to you, and you were a little ways away from Bonnie because the boys and stuff, and went over to you, and they couldn't get to you. It was like they kept trying to get to you and get past this. And it was like this, almost like a clear shield all around you, and they couldn't get to you. Mm. And I'm like, what? Looking at this thing. And then I saw a clock, and the clock, it was just like right there. And the hand started going back and back and back and back into the past really fast. And like years into the past. And then the Lord said to me, I need him to go back to that time in Portland when he cried and his mother didn't come, and he needs to give that to me and not carry it himself. And I'm like, okay. So I knew how to pray for you. Mm. And I told you the vision at the time. I told you and Bonnie both.
Oh, I don't remember that, but that would have been hard for me to hear. I would have just, I would have dismissed it immediately.
Yeah.
It was a very dark time for me.
the way people handle hurt is they put up walls. They put up walls. So then the next vision I had of you was around the time that you informed us that you were agnostic and you didn't know if you believed in God.
Then Dad dubbed me the optimistic agnostic.
Yeah, that's a good word.
I appreciate it. It fit me at the time.
I was actually very happy that you did that, because plenty of people out there that just go through the motions and, yeah, I'm a Christian, and they don't really know the Lord. I don't know, but I think that you were being honest, and I appreciated that, because that's something I've always appreciated about you.
I was being honest, and I had reasons to do it.
Yes.
What I knew of you guys and your comfort levels, and I was just like, I have to do this. I want to make it as simple as possible. And also, it's true.
Yeah, but I was still miffed. It took me a little while. I was miffed.
Mm-hmm. Why?
I was being bad.
You were being bad.
Yeah. I was not right to be miffed.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. But what did the miff say? Like, I don't know. Do you have any impression, or was it just...
It was a feeling. And isn't this podcast about emotions?
Yeah, a little bit.
This is
What's
my
emotion. What's the emotion behind that, Teresa?
I didn't take the time to examine myself yet. So what happened was, Stan and I would occasionally go up to the Gypsy Church up in Portland. And we had gone to the Gypsy Church. Amazing experience going to the Gypsy
Church.
Like,
I want to go just because of that name. Is there actually a church called the Gypsy
Church? And you want to go because of the music.
Okay.
Because you go there. It starts out Christian worship music, just what you'd hear in any church. Mm-hmm. And it's like they can't help themselves. After a while, it starts to sound more and more gypsy, wild. And I mean, it's just, it's pretty.
Like accordions start breaking out in the crowd and
everything. Oh,
I mean, can imagine.
It's so beautiful.
Sounds like
so
fun.
So anyway, we had gone to the Gypsy Church, and they had decided to do a altar call. Anybody that wanted to pray, just come up to the altar. And the Gypsy Church is like India, where the women sit on one side and the men sit on the other side. Not entirely, because some families sit together, but
or like Orthodox temples, Jewish synagogues, I believe, are like that.
It's probably like that. So the women all went up in one area of the altar. And I went up with all these gypsy women. I had one thing to pray about, and that was you. Mm. This was close to the time you told us that you were agnostic. Mm. And I went up there, and I, like I said, I was feeling miffed, and I wasn't right. Mm. So I was going to pray for you, and I started praying, and the Lord just gave me an image of you as a child, back when you were a child. And you had all this inquisitive looks in your eyes. And I just saw you. And the Lord said to me, now you can see him the way I see him. And now you can pray for him. And all the miffed feelings just disintegrated, evaporated. And I was just praying for you and crying for you. And it was at that time that I felt he heard my prayer. Mm-hmm. He was the one that was directing me in my prayer.
Well, I got to tell you at this point, like, I believe in the spiritual world. I believe that there is a world outside of this. And what you're describing, I believe in. Like, that makes perfect sense to me in a way that it never did before in my Christian days, because I didn't even understand the most basic elemental things about anything because of whatever reasons. But I think that made a huge difference.
The next and last vision I had of you was recently. We were at one of the gatherings. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, when the gatherings happen, you know how events or get-togethers will tend to go into a form, like, this is what we're doing now, this mm-hmm. is what we're doing now. And mm-hmm. so generally they'll do a bunch of songs. People mm-hmm. will request songs, sometimes testimonies. And then they'll have a prayer time and everybody will mention their prayer. And the person that's going to teach will pray about all those things rather than everybody just praying. Well, this time they mentioned, you know, anybody want to pray? Austin was leading and Austin prayed for the list. And then Desiree is a radical prayer, radical, and Laurel. Both those two are like, they're outrageous prayers.
They pray from the depths of a sincere outpouring inside them.
Yes. Yeah. So Desiree just started praying after Austin for mm-hmm. you. And then everybody in the family, it just went from the different members of the family that love you. Mm-hmm. Every one of them prayed for you. Mm-hmm. And then there was these heartfelt prayers. And in the midst of all these prayers, I had this vision of you. And all I saw was your eyes. And your eyes were filled with hurt and confusion. Mm. And then it changed and they were filled with wonder. Mm. And I'm like, what? And I was so blessed, so encouraged. Like, it's like your eyes were so real. It's like real in the way of you can't conjure up that in an imagination. Because imaginations are limited, I guess, to a degree.
When was this?
It was a few weeks ago,
okay,
maybe about a month ago, something like that.
That shift that you're describing has been happening because shifts happen so slowly.
It was right before Laurel was going to come and talk to you. Uh-huh. That was what brought it up. Okay, I remember now. Okay. That's what brought it up.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So that is what I've got on my list here to talk to you about. And the thing that I want to get across to you, just in conclusion, is I wanted to go over history so you would understand what happened and the fact that you were used as a pawn by evil men. And the other thing I want to get across to you is, if my visions are real, God wants you and loves you and has been waiting for you. And that's what I've been praying for, is that you would meet him the way I know him. And I'm not, and I want to say, oh no, he was never a Christian or he never knew the Lord. He might have had little like peeks through that door.
What do you mean by meet him the way I know him? Because I can't possibly know anything the way you do. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you can. I think
about how different your life experience has been. And the interpretation that gives you for every word, every object, everything. It's just the world you see and the world I see are different.
I'll give you the example. Did Angela tell you that I apologized to her yesterday? Did she talk to you about that?
She mentioned that you guys had a conversation that she really appreciated. She didn't give me the full details, but okay. I got that sense.
So I have not known Angela, and I've misjudged her, and I apologized for misjudging her.
Okay. Oh boy, she would appreciate that, because you get in line, Teresa. That lady is not what people think she is.
Right. So my intention is to get to know her.
Yeah, okay.
My getting to know her is going to be, I don't know her very well, but I'm opening the door.
I see.
I am going to know her, not the way you do.
Nope.
But my plan is to get to know her. And I want to love her the way I'm supposed to love her, that I haven't.
Mm.
And I'm planning to get to know Mariah's husband, and I'm planning to love him the way I ought to love him. Probably.
Oh, you're in for a treat. You're in for a treat.
Oh, yeah. He sounds so interesting. Uh-huh. And I'm delighted at how happy she seems.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. You'll understand it all by and by. It couldn't have happened any other way. It's so incredible. So cool.
I had a hard time with her two other husbands. I tried to love them, and it was challenging because I saw that they were hurting her. And I love Mariah. So there you go. That's what I'm thinking. That's all I've got to say. And someday I could talk to you about the crazy life of your stepmother, but it would have to be a very different, completely different.
Perfect. I love that. I'm learning so much about you just in this conversation and how your brain works. And I really appreciate how you have done this entire thing. Like, this is fantastic. And this is what I do it for, to see what comes out of you. I have a couple of questions for you, if I may.
Yes.
What does it all mean? Like, you're talking about some really big ideas in the spiritual world. And in, like, this whole narrative you just spun is a fantasy story. And it's all your perspective, and it's all your interpretation,
yes,
of something that I know that is actually there. And I believe, like, it all makes sense to me in my perception of it. What is, like, Morgan asked me if I'm a Christian. And I mean, that question's been building for a while. And there's all this conversation, all these undertones, and only, how old is she?
I think she just turned 6, 7.
Okay, 6 is what came to my mind. Only a 6-year-old could ask in our family and ask honestly. And so since it's an honest question, I find, to my surprise, that I cannot answer it. I don't have an answer. I don't know the answer, because I know what I think you would think. I know what I think. Like, all of my answers are what other people think. All of that confusing stuff to say that it's not simple.
No,
and it's not. Like, so what does it all mean?
It is simple, and it's not. Because Christian is just a label. And you go out there, and it's just like Catholics, Mormons. It's a label. That's all it is.
But and it means something different too.
In my opinion, it's as simple as, I'm going to give you a picture. When I was a little girl, I would pick a bouquet of flowers. I would take them out in the field, and I would say out loud, "These are for you, Jesus." And I'd lay them in the field, and I would just go inside. And I would never go back to see if he took them, because either one, if he didn't take them, it was scary. And if he did take them, it was scary.
Mm.
I would never go back. It was as simple as just believing that he got those flowers and knew that I was giving them to him. That's how simple to me Christianity is.
Mm.
So I loved him. And then one day, I made him Lord. To me, it's nothing more complicated than, okay, I'm not going to choose what I'm going to do. I'm going to look to you because you are now the king in my life. Simple as that for me.
And those are all words that mean different things to different people too. And that's where we come to always in these conversations. There is mystery to be had.
Yeah.
Good enough. Teresa, thank you so much. I didn't know what to expect from this conversation. And now I feel like I don't know what to expect from the next conversation, which is a fantastic feeling. It's going to happen when it happens. But thank you for this moment. This is incredible.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this. I hope I did okay.
Oh, you did fantastic. Thank you, Emotion Art team, for making this conversation sound so good. Original music and audio quality is Buddy Anderson.
Check out his music on Spotify at From Another Mista. And Angela Cook, thanks for doing what you do. Peace.